It's November, and it's Friday the 13th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, world powers prepare to meet again, seeking an end to the Syrian war.
Very often, even the human rights lawyers themselves would be subject to torture and ill-treatment.
A human rights group says police torture remains rampant in China. Also ahead, an animal rights group scores a victory in Vietnam. There's a lady in the van you may see here at the movie theater. It's all coming up on today's International Edition. A second round of international talks is scheduled in Vienna Saturday on ways to end the nearly five-year Syrian civil war, with a key item expected to be how to decide which opposition groups Damascus is willing to negotiate a political solution with. In a communique following last month's first round, the 17 world powers, the UN and the EU, agreed on the importance of accelerating diplomatic efforts and a UN-led effort to reach a ceasefire. Regional analyst David Leitch of Trinity University in Texas told VOA's Victor Beatty, while the future of President Bashar al-Assad also remains a key obstacle to peace, the opposition remains fragmented.
And finding a so-called acceptable opposition, certainly to the Syrian government and its supporters, Iran and Russia, any of those that have been deemed as terrorists, which is almost anybody fighting the Syrian government, are deemed as unacceptable. What's interesting is that many of those are also deemed unacceptable by a number of countries in the West, including the United States, such as Ahrar al-Sham, which many would say is a radical Islamist group that is kind of a homegrown version of Jabhat al-Nusra, the al-Qaeda branch in Syria. And of course, groups like ISIS are totally off the table. So finding an acceptable opposition, if you just get the opposition that the Russians want or that the Syrian government is willing to negotiate with, you have very little legitimacy amongst those Syrian opposition who have been fighting and dying for almost 5 years now. You know, that's a very small portion of the opposition. The crux of any political settlement depends on whether or not you can get the Syrian government to agree to concessions that are constitutionally encoded without caveat that can satisfy at least the minimum demands of a critical mass of the opposition. I just don't think there's any way right now that the Vienna talks and the lists that people are drawing up are going to come up with a critical mass of the opposition who can bring enough of the opposition to the table, particularly, you know, via a ceasefire, which seems to be what everyone's working for before you even get to, you know, the many issues that divide Syrians today. But can you get enough of them to the table at all? And I don't think you can right now.
How can the West and Russia come to an agreement on the opposition?
Well, it's going to be a lot of horse trading. Each side at some point have to make concessions with regard to who they deem the acceptable opposition, acceptable in terms of being an opposition group with whom the Syrian government could agree to negotiate with. Right now, the Syrian government, basically anybody that's fighting it, is a terrorist group. And Russia has, and to a certain degree Iran, has adopted that same definition. So the Russians and the Syrian government and the Iranians, and particularly the Russians and Iranians, probably will have to put pressure on the Syrian government to open the net wider in terms of who is an acceptable opposition. And I think the West will as well. I think the United States and European countries will have to accept certain armed Islamist opposition groups that aren't Jabhat al-Nusra, that aren't ISIS, as negotiating partners, or else you're just not going to reach that critical mass.
David, there appears to be a Russian proposal that is being circulated that calls for drafting a new constitution within 18 months. Put to a popular referendum, followed by early presidential elections, but it makes no mention of President Bashar al-Assad stepping down during any transition period. What do you make of that?
They're trying, I think, the Russians to, through early elections, bring some legitimacy to Bashar al-Assad. And, of course, many in the West and many players in the region, you know, want to see quite the opposite.
David Leitch says the burden is on Damascus to state what political reforms it is prepared to discuss, including amendments to the Constitution. That, he says, must be preceded by a ceasefire. A Broadway number called Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend is a well-known song here in America, but it seems like the high-tech industry is also looking to get a little bit chummy with a precious stone. For more on that, International Edition's G. Abby Lee joins me in Studio 22. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim. Now I have to give you a full disclosure before I begin. I stumbled upon today's story because of an endorsement by actor Leonardo DiCaprio. He's on Twitter at Leo DiCaprio, and he tweeted this. Proud to invest in Diamond Foundry, a company reducing human and environmental toll by sustainably culturing diamonds. And he left a link to the company's website, which is diamondfoundry.com. That tweet got almost 2,000 likes and more than 600 retweets.
So what exactly does this company do?
It produces diamonds as opposed to extracting them in California. The company explains it discovered plasma that allows atoms to attach themselves to a thin slice of diamond that's been extracted the old-fashioned way. The atoms then are stacked on top of the diamond's crystal structure and grow layers, making the diamond bigger.
I see. So you need actually some amount of real diamond plucked from the earth to begin with. And what are these diamonds for?
Well, the company claims it creates jewelry-grade diamonds, so I'm guessing that's the main purpose. Jim, if they can produce diamonds that are just as brilliant as conventional diamonds, that can really change the mining industry and the way we shop for that. The traditional way of mining diamonds is known to harm the environment and to use forced child labor in some cases.
I'm presuming we can find this company on Twitter?
Yes, you can. Its handle is at Diamond Foundry, but it only has 11 followers and a couple of tweets so far. The account actually retweeted DiCaprio's tweet and added this. After 3 years, we are thrilled to launch D Foundry. Thank you, Leo DiCaprio, and all our investors. Forever starts now. I'm guessing the company's account was set up today, actually. And I'm sure many of our listeners knew this, but just wanted to add that DiCaprio played a gem smuggler in the 2006 film Blood Diamond. Back to you, Jim.
Well, when I see that big rock on your finger, I may know where it came from. Thank you for the brilliant update, G. You can both follow G and myself on Twitter. She's at G Abby Lee. I'm at VOA Stevenson. And this is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Amnesty International says in a new report that Chinese police still routinely use torture to extract confessions from criminal suspects. International Edition host Sarah Williams speaks with Amnesty's China researcher Patrick Poon in Hong Kong. He was the leading contributor to the report.
In our report, actually, we highlight that in Chinese law, in fact, only they touch on the issue of extracting confession and using violence to obtain evidence. I mean, like, it's actually not enough to just to include these two areas, because in many of those cases we also highlighted in the report, we talked to lawyers and actually also academics. What we find out is that to those people, especially dissidents, human rights defenders, Falun Gong practitioners, religious believers, and even like corrupt officials, they can also be subject to torture when they detain. For example, like for corrupt officials, if they are under the party disciplinary action, Zhuangwei, the double registration, and during the investigation by the procuratorate, the prosecutors, They can also be subject to torture, as we all heard from lawyers who handle cases like that. So that happens to also to other human rights defenders. They handle the case, the lawyers handle those cases. And very often, even the human rights lawyers themselves would be subject to torture and ill treatment. And like, for example, in the case of Yi Wen-shen, Beijing lawyer, after he put something online last year supporting the Hong Kong protests, and he was detained for 99 days, he was subject to a long period of interrogations for up to 200 times, as he told us. So you can see that actually lawyers themselves would even be subject to this kind of torture in detention.
Another thing that is used in an area called a use of something called a black jail, where people are taken to sort of a secret location.
Yeah, exactly. Like for black jail, it's a kind of arbitrary detention in China, and there's no law in China to prohibit that. While this actually, in practice, what we hear from lawyers are quite rampant among human rights defenders, long-term practitioners, Falun Gong practitioners, religious believers, etc. So all these people actually would be detained in places, in unknown places, for example, even like in hotels, guest house, or even in abandoned flats or in underground rooms. So it's actually very dangerous and very risky for them to be detained in such locations, because it would expose them to higher risk of torture. While actually nobody can find them. When these people are detained, they don't have any access to lawyers and their family. So it exposed them to even more risk of torture.
Since 2010, China has introduced a number of guidelines it says have successfully reduced torture. Amnesty says the measures have been ineffective, partly because the courts involved are controlled by the ruling Communist Party. Vietnam currently has more than 1,200 bears caged and facing the practice of regular bile extraction, which is then used in traditional medicine. The bears, mostly moon bears, suffer from tiny cages, inadequate diets, little or no veterinary care, and painful extractions for their bile. Bear bile extractions have now ended in Quang Ninh province thanks to animal welfare charity Animals Asia. The final bear, named Hercules, was rescued just last week. Animals Asia founder and CEO Jill Robinson joins us. This has been a long struggle for you and your co-workers.
Well, it's been a long journey, Jim. We've been working there since 2008 and have seen the most egregious practices to bears on bile farms across the country, as, of course, many other NGOs that have been working there have seen too. But we've been particularly interested in Quang Ninh province and working with the government to end the industry there once and for all. And we thought we were quite close after we did a very in-depth investigation of the bear bile farms. We made a report to the government, and although we got the sort of go-ahead to close that province down, the farmers themselves dug their heels in, and many of them refused to go. And it's just been, you know, since May of this year, really, that we finally got the green light from the Prime Minister and were able to start the rescue of these bears. So our very last bear was rescued about 10 days ago in Vietnam, in Quang Ninh province. And as you said, the whole province now is bile farm free, which is a fantastic place to be, really, and gives us great incentive to keep on until there's no more bile farming in Vietnam as a whole.
What was the incentive in that area to keep these farms going? Was it economic? Was it cultural? A combination of things?
Sadly, it was as a result of greed. There could be no other adjective for that. It's obviously a very popular tourist area, so they were getting tourists coming in around Ha Long Bay on the cruise ships there and then coming out and buying bile from, you know, bears that were anaesthetized in front of them and you know, walking away with either bear bile wine or little vials of bear bile that they have bought from a freshly tapped bear. So the whole thing was just obviously steeped in illegality, because bear farming is illegal in Vietnam.
What was the scale of this in this particular province? About how many farms?
Well, many, many farms. And, you know, goodness, I think by the time we were looking at about 49 bears in Ha Long Bay alone. And by the time that we were allowed to actually start the rescue, I think about 30 of those bears had actually died or had been killed by the farmers. So then we were able to rescue the remainder of those and then go into the rest of the province and rescue the remainder. So, as I say, it's been a long, long journey there, but it's just such a feeling of great satisfaction to be able to close the door on that industry in Kunming province and to now work with the government in the hope that we can close the industry there once and for all. And it's also working with, obviously, the Traditional Medicine Association there as well, because they have also pledged for their members to stop selling and prescribing bear bile by the year 2020. So it gives us a great incentive now to work with them and with the government to finally make bear farming a thing of the past in 5 years' time.
What become of the bears that you rescue?
Obviously, this is our responsibility now for the 30-year lifespan of these animals. We've rescued 568 bears, actually, in China and Vietnam into our sanctuaries. It's a massive program that we have. It's a massive expense, of course, to be able to keep these animals well-fed, well-managed, have severe veterinary intervention because several of them will need their gallbladders removed because they're so badly damaged and compromised as a result of the mutilation and having their bile extracted. You know, we have a huge catalogue of injuries that we have to deal with, but, you know, that is our job. It's what we took on.
Jill Robinson is the founder and CEO of Animals Asia. Jill, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
VOA Special English. A way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
I'm Victor Beatty. Since 1942, the Voice of America has been a consistently reliable and authoritative source of news. Today, VOA remains committed to providing an accurate, objective, and comprehensive news product at the top of every hour, every day. We can be heard on your local affiliate or streamed on the web at voanews.com.
A new movie starring Academy Award winner Maggie Smith mirrors the real-life experience of British playwright Alan Bennett and a homeless woman he let live in his driveway. International Edition's David Byrd tells us about The Lady in the Van.
Many fans know Maggie Smith from her role as the Dowager Countess on the hit drama Downton Abbey. But Smith has shed her upper-crust finery in the halls of Highclere Castle for a rusted van parked in London's Camden Town in the new film, The Lady in the Van. The story follows the real-life encounter playwright Alan Bennett had with Mary Shepherd, a homeless woman who lived in a van in his driveway in the 1970s. After he helps Shepherd, a former concert pianist reduced to living in a Bedford van, she ends up staying in his driveway for 15 years. Nicholas Heitner, the former director of Britain's National Theatre, directed the movie. He says that The Lady in the Van features many of the same locations on which the real-life drama played out.
The house is more or less unchanged. The study you see in the film is as it was. I visited it often. I've been directing Alan's plays for a very long time now. The street is I think the street has not changed for 150 years, apart from the cars parked outside the houses. The van, obviously, is a replica, not the real van. And when it came driving up the street for the first time, I think a lot of the neighbours had very mixed feelings about that, because she was not a great neighbour.
Olivier Award-winning actor Alex Jennings plays Alan Bennett, who is eventually cast into a caregiving role, one he has refused for his own mother, whom he committed to a nursing home.
I don't encourage her to think she can become Prime Minister. I do encourage her to try and get to the supermarket.
Yes. A carer will often feel that he
Excuse
or she...
Excuse me, may I stop you? Do not call me the carer. I am not the carer. I hate caring. I hate the thought. I hate the word. I do not care and I do not care for. I am here. She is there. There is no caring.
Jennings says that Bennett approved of his performance in the film.
And he's now gone on record as suspecting that I always did him. And I've now been given the opportunity to go public with it. But having him around has been fantastically important, and his suggestions and his criticism sometimes and his support has been a huge part of the whole process.
Jennings says that working with Maggie Smith and her approval of his performance in The Lady in the Van gave him a big confidence boost.
I just am in awe of the equipment she has, the kind of number of tools in her tool bag. Phenomenal. From, you know, she started out in revue, she can do high comedy, she can do low comedy, she can do raw naked tragedy. She's the breadth of what she's got is extraordinary, and it was a real privilege on this to sort of witness that. And she's fantastically collaborative and supportive.
Smith's performance has won over the critics, but Heitner says he's not sure she is willing to play the games necessary to win an Oscar.
This is a career that goes back more than 60 years. She's got two Oscars already. She worked with John Ford and George Cukor. She played Betty Davis's maid, so I think she's probably happy to stick.
The Lady in the Van opens in the UK this month. It opens in the United States in January. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
You've been listening to International Edition. We're at our website, voanews.com, where you can hear us any time of the day or night. And we're also on Twitter. Follow us at @VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter. Our engineer, Zeynep Abdel-Rahman. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We thank you for joining us. We hope you have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. Deputy National Security Advisor Benjamin Rhodes announced on October 16th $2.2 million in new U.S. support for Laos National Mine Clearance Operator, UXOs Lao, which will enable it to rehire trained technicians it lost in 2014 as a result of funding difficulties. The UXO Lao teams will be deployed in Wampan, Sing Quang, Quan Mon, Savanakhet, Salavan, and Champasak provinces. Mr. Rhodes said that the United States is committed to helping Laos clear unexploded ordnance, or UXO, contaminated areas in order to reduce casualties and to increase the productivity of agricultural lands to reduce poverty. Mr. Rhodes recently visited a UXO Lao team clearing unexploded ordnance from Bonpaku village in Luang Prabang province. The UXO Lao team briefed Mr. Rhodes on its progress in the village and described the training that the team members must undertake in order to work in this sector. Mr. Rhodes said that he was impressed by the UXO Lao team's commitment to this work, which is so important for the Lao people and especially for the younger generation. With the new contribution, the United States will have provided more than $100 million in mine action and UXO-related assistance to Laos. Priority funding will support clearance of UXO found as a result of evidence-based survey, a cutting-edge technique that identifies contaminated areas more effectively and efficiently than ever before. Victims assistance programs will provide direct services to survivors of unexploded ordnance accidents and their families, and help strengthen first aid and emergency response of key health facilities and village volunteers in heavily impacted provinces. Funding for risk awareness supports education of Lao citizens, especially children, about the dangers of UXO. USAID's Leahy War Victims Fund provided funding to the Cooperative Orthotic Prosthetic Enterprise to support physical rehabilitation programs, including prosthetics, orthotics, and mobility aids to nearly 4,500 people, including 1,500 children. The United States is proud to work with Laos and its non-governmental partners to free the people of Laos from the threat of landmines, unexploded ordnance, and other deadly remnants of war.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.